Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning. We continue our series on the rudiments unto perfection, the whole counsel of God, lesson number 50, entitled Of Delay and Dismay. Delay and Dismay. Matter of fact, next week's lesson will also be on delay and sin. This morning, we're going to be focusing on what we perceive as God's delays and the fact that God's delays tend to dismay us. In other words, they are a test of our faith when God delays to answer our prayers or our needs or solve our problems or remedy a situation. And I make a distinction between God's apparent delays and the delays of men. There are situations that when a man delays, sin is involved. I give two examples without stealing thunder from next week's message. But, for example, when a judge delays to render justice, as in the parable of the importunate widow that kept coming to the judge and says, "Avenge me of my enemy," and he would not. And finally, he is browbeaten into finally acting, as it were. And that delay denied her justice, for every day that the judge delayed, justice was not served by the judge in his capacity. He didn't do his job. Therefore, the widow suffered. So delay in justice is sinful. Delay in paying wages is esteemed a sin in Scripture, where someone has earned the money, they should have that money, but the payment isn't showing up on the door. The employer decides, come back tomorrow or next week, I'll have the money then. This form of delay is also sinful. Not all delay is sinful. Some delay is just personal kind of things when people are involved in. But there are instances where there's sinful delay, and we want to avoid that. The other is a matter of, let's try not to annoy one another by delaying things. But I'm not certain that sin is involved in all instances of inadvertent delay. But we want to concentrate on not sinning. But that's for next week. Now we're going to concentrate on delay of God. Last week we discussed that the delays of God can give rise to sin, occasion to sin, very obviously. Now we want to take it to the point where we're talking about saved individuals, the church, as a family, as a body of God, and how they respond to God's delays, the test that it puts our faith to, and the lessons that we can learn from it, that God many times works in the large. We know He concentrates on little things, no question about it, but on the time scales of history, He sometimes has a much bigger picture than we can ever imagine. And because His picture is into the centuries, frequently we feel that we've been lost or in the shuffle, which we have not. We have our part to play. But it doesn't mean that we're necessarily the generation to see deliverance or salvation or righteousness break forth and bud on the continent. We may not be. We may, in fact, be due for several centuries of slavery. We don't know that. And God has chosen not to reveal these things to His church because He has revealed Himself through His Son better than, say, the revelation that Abraham had. And Abraham, therefore, did get some clues as to God's delays. God even put some time frames on them. And needless to say, every time God delayed to do something, men found fault with it or were tested by it, and they were pushed to the limit of their faith. Let's start with Genesis 15, shall we? There's actually two different examples in Genesis 15 of delay. Three different examples of delay in chapter 15. Now that I'm glancing at it again. Start with verse 5. God is speaking to Abraham. And he, God, brought Abraham, that's him, he brought him forth abroad, that is outside, outdoors, and said, "Look now toward heaven and tell the stars, if thou be able to number them." And he said unto him, "So shall thy seed be." At what time of day is Abraham brought out to look at the stars? Daylight or nighttime? Nighttime. He's brought out to count the stars. So it's like probably early morning, sometime after midnight, maybe 3 a.m., 4 a.m., something like that. God is speaking in the still of the night. Look, count the stars. Your seed shall be as this in number. Then he's received, he believed it, and the Lord said unto him, "I am the Lord that brought thee out of Ur the Chaldees to give thee this land to inherit it." And Abraham asked God, whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it? And he said unto him, "Take me an heifer of 3 years old, she-goat of 3 years old, ram of 3 years old, and a turtle dove and a young pigeon." And he took unto him all these and divided them in the midst, meaning that Abraham knew what to do with them. The provisions for the sacrifices of the Mosaic law were well known to Abraham. So anyone who says law came first with Moses is mistaken. Sacrificial procedures and cutting these things in pieces was observed by Abraham. Laid each piece one against another, but the birds divided he not. Now here's where it's interesting. Now he sets up the sacrifice just as God has ordained, early in the morning. And when the fowls, that's the vultures, the buzzards, that's the fowls that he's talking about, the carrion eaters, came down from the carcasses, or upon the carcasses, Abraham drove them away. In other words, as he's standing guard over these sacrifices, he has to drive away the vultures all day long. And I say all day long because we find out immediately thereafter, and when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abraham. He was there all day long beating vultures off of the sacrifice. God hasn't spoken to him yet. Where's God? What's Abraham's reaction to the fact that God has not done? He would stay there weeks if necessary now that he's done what God has told him to do. The delay was only for a day. But most people would say, all right, like Elijah, oh God, burn the offering, and boom, it happens, right? This didn't happen to Abraham. He got the heifer, he killed them, he cut them in pieces like he was supposed to, he set up the sacrifice on the altar, and then he had to spend all day fighting buzzards. Isn't that what it says in verse 10? Or 11, when the fowls came down upon the carcasses, Abraham drove them away. He probably couldn't do anything about the flies, but the buzzards, he certainly didn't want to spoil what he had prepared for God that God asked him to give. But God didn't receive it till later in the evening, even though it was prepared immediately in the morning. You see, delay on God's part didn't sway Abraham one iota. He just kept hitting the buzzards. He was willing to wait as long as God took because he was waiting on God. It didn't matter to him how long it took to get the answer. How many times would we say, God, I'm going to do this for you, and all of a sudden we start falling under attack, and what we thought was an imminent release, say, of funds or resources or whatever, or an answer that or legislation that would pop through, or a president would do something, boom, it's delayed and delayed and delayed, and we're sitting there getting shot in the back with arrows, or having to do all sorts of dirty work, like here fighting buzzards. Most of us would despair and say, obviously God's not in it. I must have been mistaken. You know, I did what I thought God wanted to do, but all I ended up doing was having to fight buzzards all day. Well, this wasn't Abraham's attitude, is it? If it was good enough for Abraham to sit there with a stick all day and beat off a bunch of buzzards that were coming to eat the sacrifice away, then there's nothing too shameful or dirty for Christians to do if they're waiting on God. There's no reason for us to turn the head and say, forget this noise, so to speak. I don't want anything to do with this kind of stuff. God obviously is not going to talk to me. God has not spoken. I'm on the wrong track, and I can tell it clearly. Well, if anyone had reason to think he was on the wrong track and must have had a bad dream and not had God speak to him at night, it was Abraham, right? Or Abram, to say. Not yet called Abraham, but Abram. Who had reason more than Abram to question his path, his course, because of the delay of God? He was there guarding that sacrifice as long as it took till God spoke. Character. God's delay put Abraham's faith to the test, and it wasn't budged one iota. Remember, this is a man who staggered not at the promise of God that he should have children, so why should it bother him that God takes all day long to do something with the sacrifice that was set up? Even though Abraham's an old man, I'm sure he didn't need to sit there and have to fight with vultures all day long. But he did, as the verse tells us. When the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and lo, an horror of great darkness fell upon him. And he said, God said unto Abram, know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them for 400 years. 400 years of affliction under Egypt is going to be the portion of Abram's seed, his children, and grandchildren, great-grandchildren. 400 years of this. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance, and thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace. Abram will be spared having to see any of his children go through the 400 years of suffering. It will begin after Abram's dead. Thou shalt be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. Now, there's several elements of delay here. We first talked about the delay in God's dealing with the sacrifice, showing up to speak to him in the sleep all day long. Second delay is that you're not going to come into this land. Matter of fact, your people are going to be put under judgment for 4 centuries. Then they come out. And now, why does it have to be 4 generations delay on top? Why is that imposed? The reason is given here. In the fourth generation, they shall come hither, again here to Canaan, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. This is another reason for delay. Yes, Israel was to possess the land of Canaan, but God will not dispossess the Amorites prior to giving them time to repent, which they won't have, but they will have had it. Their iniquity is not yet full. They have not yet sinned so greatly that they should be thrown out of the land and Israel replace them. Everyone clear here? God's not going to jump the gun and say, all right, I'm going to throw out the Amorites right now. There was no just cause to throw out the Amorites. God is a gracious God and merciful. And even though the Amorites were sinners, they had not yet gotten to a fever pitch where God, like dealing with Sodom and Gomorrah, said they filled their cup to the full. Bam, out comes judgment. Sodom and Gomorrah, yes, they blew it. And by the time Israel showed up at Canaan's doors under the leadership of Joshua, yes, the iniquity was full and they were ready to be exterminated off the land. But in Abram's day, not yet true. Just because the land is promised to you doesn't mean you have a right to take it, that God will let you enter in and take it. So too, as evil as America might be today, and there's much evil in it and much righteousness in it, its cup of iniquity may not be full. Christians may not be coming in to dispossess the unrighteous for another century. It may not be time to take over like the Reconstructionists have sometimes taught, like Dr. North in particular, says it's just around the corner when the Christians will come take everything over and we'll run the place. Well, it may be that America, like the Amorites, America, Amorite, almost sounds the same, doesn't it? The iniquity is not yet full, not yet finished, not yet worthy of such a judgmental blow as to dislodge them from the land. Even keeping in mind that verse in Leviticus, that iniquity of the land will cause the land to vomit out the inhabitants, it takes a while for the land to get that sick, for God to finally expel everybody out of it. Not yet sick enough. Sickly, yes, a country is very sick. 50 million dead babies, or I guess the number is much bigger than that. That's the number historically used, and every year it's incremented. Still not bad enough, perhaps. We don't know God's timetable. Abraham was shared the timetable. Okay. Yes, question. Two hands were up. Thursday, the day when the world will end. I better get those library books back. How am I going to return them otherwise? Okay. All right. So, three different kinds of delay on God's part. Is God a God of delay? Only from man's perspective, right? That's the interesting thing. When we talk about of delay and dismay, we're really talking about God and time. God and time. People are bound to the clock. If I cook dinner, which Jan will immediately tell you, what? What are you talking about? Okay, but if it should happen that I throw something in the oven, I can't leave it there till tomorrow cooking to expect it to be right. It's going to be perfect at a certain point, and thereafter it's going to burn and fry and end up being a real mess on the bottom of that pan, right? Harvest time. The reason that time was such an important thing, and the time markers, by the way, we don't rely them on them as much as they did in the old days. Nowadays, we have a calendar on our desks made of pieces of paper with numbers on it, but they had to trust the sun and the moon and the stars to tell them, now it's time to plant, now it's time to water and fertilize, and now it's time to harvest. And if you didn't harvest in time, it would overly ripe, and it would be spoiled. If you harvested too early, it wouldn't be ripe and taste rotten. If you didn't plant at the right time, you wouldn't get a good harvest, if any at all. You see? So men and women, humanity, is tied to the clock, and we're very sensitive about it. God sometimes sticks that almost in our face to say he's not time bound down like that. He's not bound down by the fact that Sarah is over 90 years old. Not bound down by the fact of how old Abraham is. It doesn't bother him that our idea of time and when things should be timely done is not binding on him. You see? I can show you, we will show examples in Scripture where even righteous men who've already gone to heaven question God's timing. Not necessarily sinful, but certainly the question always arises. Because we're finite, because we're time-bound people, we find that our faith is tested most when God shows his sovereignty over time by his choosing of when to do things or when not to do things, when to act, when not to act. So sometimes it's scary to us. Very scary. Exodus 1. Verse 8. Now there rose a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. He said unto his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal with them wisely, lest they multiply and come to pass. They join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Therefore did they set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. First point here is some bad news. They arose up in the land, king who knew not Joseph. Nowadays we have men rising up in the land, our land, that know not Washington and Adams and Madison, Hamilton, the Constitution for that matter, and are more than willing to shut down anyone who does point out the promises and the covenants that were established and the nation was founded on. And then the question arises that they're put into service and they're shut down and they're controlled and they're enslaved. And then the delay is even further. God does answer the prayer, though no one knows it, as they cry out unto God for deliverance. Man has to be born. Moses, chapter 2, he has to live quite some time, 40 years, and then 40 years again in Midian. In chapter 2, verse 23, we read, And it came to pass in the process of time that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of their bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of their bondage. And God heard the groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, and Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect unto them. And then it was time for God finally to speak to Moses. But this is still 80 years from the birth of Moses. So man may have been born, and he not come into the picture to dominate the scene till his 80th birthday. God's time frame being what it is. And now God acts. In terms of that 400 years he told Abraham about, the time has come to act. So, how long a delay was this? The person to rescue America from its downward slide may not be born yet, and he may not act until he's 80 years old either. We don't know. It is absolute pure presumption to say we're on the verge of Christian victory. Pat Robertson will lead his coalition against the troops, and Buchanan is Catholics, and blah, blah, blah. Maybe. And we hope so. We don't know that. There were many false messiahs before Jesus showed up, and there are many afterward. Ben Bar Kokhba and a whole bunch of others that tried to lead the nation astray. And what benefit did it have those who forced the hand of God? None. None whatsoever.
Hey, Omar, it also would be presumptuous to even think that there will be somebody born in 80 years. America may be on the way.
Right, we don't know anything about that. God,
we know that the church, that God will build his church, that we know.
Right.
But whether or not America will be involved, this we don't.
Right. We think that God has national plans for us or other nations, but God's plans are all supernational, not supernatural, but supernational. They're above the realm of the nations. He sits as king enthroned over them, and his plans are even bigger than the UN's plans for the country. Okay? Believe it or not. And his aren't totalitarian in the evil sense. Exodus 12, verse 40. This is explaining the Passover meal as commemoration. Now the sojourning of the children of Israel, who dwelt in Egypt, was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, even the selfsame day it came to pass, that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. It was a night to be much observed unto the Lord for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. This is that night of the Lord to be observed of all the children of Israel and their generations. This night says 430 years to the day that they entered Egypt. So it's pretty amazing when you get down to it. God, his timetable can be much more precise than ours. We can't plan anything to 430 years to the day and say, well, 430 years from today, such and so is going to happen, right? Well, my great-great-great-grandson is going to cross the Delaware River, or the river, or something like that, or is going to win a Pulitzer Prize and receive it at 8 p.m. tonight on, you know, the year 2392, or whatever it may be. No way you're going to be able to make that claim. they knew of the claim from beforehand. In other words, they preserved this promise for a half a millennium, and its fulfillment by God was set in the record and confirmed. But that's still amazing, 430 years of suffering. And then, boom, God delivers. As promised, on schedule. Now, what I'm telling you here is that in the Old Testament period, God would give the time frames, and he delivered. And he did this over and over again. I'll show you several more examples, to the end that in our age, after Jesus came, he doesn't have to give us the timetables. We should have learned to trust that when he acts, he will act sovereignly, wisely, with infinite wisdom and justice, and do righteously in the land. If he has shown himself that to the very day he can pull them out of Egypt 430 years after their ingress through Joseph and Ishmael and the others, however you want to start counting that period, boom, he nails it on the head. Next example. Yes, question.
Is this the 400 years he told him in the dream?
Yes.
Why is it 400 once and 430? Is there some reason for that other 30 years or something that just doesn't come out in the dream?
Yeah, Isaac wasn't born for 30 more years. So the promise was made. Galatians 3:17 says 430 years from the promise being delivered to that. But it wasn't until Ishmael apparently was driven out at Isaac's bar mitzvah that's where the process started, the timing. There's some slight difference of opinion on that depending who you're going, but apparently the sharp exegetes as well as your devotional ones like Matthew Henry agree the process started with Ishmael leaving for Egypt, or Egyptian soil. And then, of course, Joseph was sold into slavery into Egypt, and that was the beginning of larger mass transit into regions of Goshen and whatnot. So, all this to say that this example, as well as the other ones we just got through from Genesis 15, show that God's delays are divine delays. We always say, it's a divine delay. Oh, great, God's divinely delaying again. But we shouldn't see it that way. We should see it, what a wondrous thing it is that God is delaying. This time he hasn't told us when what's called the terminus ad quo is, which is the end of that delay, when the deliverance will come, or if the deliverance will come, as we don't know from what quarter it comes, or what nation will take the torch up. Don't know that for a certainty. But the fact that we're on God's timetable at all means that we're in the best of possible hands, no matter what our personal lot or our family's lot may be in our nation. We know what our responsibilities and duties are, but we should not be concerned about God's timetable, because it's always in good hands. Yes.
Now you mentioned we don't know what nation it will be, but I think we know that there will be many nations.
Many.
Because we know of nations, all the nations coming to Jerusalem to worship.
That's right.
So we know that there will be a diversity of nations involved in the end time.
The nations maintain their individual identities, and we would therefore have a sense of patriotism. Isaiah 19 talks about Assyria, Egypt, and Israel, each being a member of a confederation that did in fact worship God equally well and equally righteously,
right,
with full
duties. Right. We don't
duties.
Look for a particular nation
no.
to lead us.
But I'm saying that our nation may be in decline, that it's not going to... This came off the lips of Dr. Douglas Kelly. He said, we don't know whether America goes down the tube, becomes a great pagan sourced by the world, and deliverance comes from Africa, and the gospel re-extends out from where Augustine once tread, not from these shores. We don't know from what quarter salvation will re-extend. Other than that, the law will go forth from Jerusalem, and I take that to mean the word of God from the words that are in the Bible. Okay, so we're seeing the picture here. And I also should point out, we just read from Exodus 2:23, it says, in process of time, that king died. In process of time. Okay. God is not... I want to be real careful with the word process of time, because there's a thing called process theology, which has very little to do with the Bible and everything to do with atheistic humanism. And we're not going to talk about that, and we don't even have to define it, because it's a messy doctrine designed to get around what the scriptures say and to make it a mythical book. But in process of time is to say that certain things must go through their normal lifespan. The Amorites must stay another 4 generations in the land because they've not yet filled up the cup of iniquity. They will, But that process of filling is going to continue until it's done. See? And so if we have, you know, eventually, in process of time, Russia fell apart. Let's take a case in point. As more and more the old regime died, and certain policies were put into effect, it eventually fell under its own weight. It was a natural process of time for this Egyptian pharaoh to die, the one that threatened Moses with death. And a new pharaoh, is probably his son or his nephew, take the throne. So there you have it, in process of time. God many times does allow the world to run by its cycles. We'll see an example of that. We see that this was 430 years to the day that they came out, that the death knell was placed on the firstborn of Egypt, which delivered Israel finally. And they left Egypt and were able to encamp by the Red Sea. And they had one last altercation with the Egyptians. The one Egyptian never got very close to any Israelis. The Egyptians did get a lot, very close to salt water at that point, to God's glory. Yes, but process of time. Now another example that's very clear is that the land was denied its Sabbaths prior to the Babylonian captivity. And we read the tail end of Chronicles, and Jeremiah concludes the same thing, that the land shall have its Sabbaths. For every sabbatical year missed by Israel, let me explain that for those who don't know, God says you can plant the ground and harvest it for 6 years. The seventh year after that, you don't touch the ground, you just let it sit there. You don't plant food. You do with the food that you have in your granaries. God promised you'll put a little extra in there over those 6 years, so you have plenty left for the seventh year when you don't plant. Well, Israel thought they knew better. They planted on the seventh year over and over, so they never stopped planting. They all planted every single year, and they skipped observing that every seventh year, like 1907, 1914, 1921, etc., that you don't plant. You leave the field alone, you rest the field. God says, my land will have its Sabbaths. They violated and missed the Sabbath year 70 times. So for 70 years, I'm going to throw them out of the land, and the land will rest for those 70 years that were denied to it. Again, God using the cycles of nature and saying, we will keep throw them out for 70 years. The nation was so abject and dejected and heartbroken at being cast out and their king led away, Zedekiah, and blinded and make it a captive in the house of the Babylonians. Boom. What can they say? They felt that God had abandoned them. So what a shock when God brings them back after the 70 years are up. Okay? God's timetable, 70 years out of the land. You don't know when America is going to be thrown out. Uh-oh. This reminds me of the Syrophoenician woman's claim, you know, even the dogs lick the crumbs from under the table. But you're making your own crumbs, dog. Okay, back to our message. Back to the message. Another important element is the promise made to Daniel. 77s is determined or decreed upon your nation and the people and the city, Jerusalem. This is in Daniel 9, the famous 70 weeks prophecy, which all commentators take to be a predicted period of 490 years, split into three sub-periods of 742 and 1, totaling the 49. And it says from this period to the building of that, to the period coming to the Messiah showing up, and then to the destructions being decreed on the city. All planned out centuries in advance, is what Reshtuni says. The offense of the book of Daniel is it charts the course of empire for centuries to come. And this makes it unpalatable book and an objectionable book, particularly to pagans. It will not buy that God's hand is ruling and calling the shots centuries in advance, everything moving into place. So God and time, we have to deal with somebody who doesn't just have 70 years to live. And his influence is only limited to that. His influence is unlimited over the entire world. He can do with it as he pleases, and no one can stay his hand and say, what doest thou? To use the phrase of Daniel again. God's in charge. God's in charge of the time. And the faithful will acquiesce. We will accept it and walk in faith. Our faith will not be shaken by God's delays. Matter of fact, that's why, since God is a God who, to the human eyes, delays constantly, we must learn to wait upon the Lord. That's why the phrase, wait upon the Lord, is so consistent in Scripture. It's because God's not going to act when you expect Him to or when the best time for you to act is. It's going to be when He wants to act. And it's much better than your idea, but it's going to look like a delay, like you've been left in the lurch. And that's what walking in faith is going to be, dealing with a God who is King of time, and not stuck to the clock like we are. Turn with me to John, chapter 11. By the way, there was a unknown, not quite unknown, but almost unknown, delay between the writing of the last book of the Old Testament and the New Testament period. It was called the Great Silence between Malachi's composition and James writing the very first canonical book of the New Testament in the early 50s A.D. Huge period of silence. Was God speaking? God was very active through the whole period of time. But there was no canon, no scriptures being generated. Was God delaying? Sure. But it was in God's plan, and it was the best possible delay that we could have. But it was misinterpreted as God has left us. He hadn't left us. Remember, he said 490 years, and that time was still ticking off during that big gap. Okay. Now, a certain man was sick named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. And it was Mary which anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore his sisters sent unto him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom thou lovest is sick. They sent unto him. That means they sent a messenger to Jesus. The messenger or messengers showed up at Jesus, where Jesus was staying, which was outside of Judea, some distance away. Why? Because the Jews threatened to kill him, so they withdrew to stay away from the reach of the Jews. They sent a messenger. When Jesus heard that, he said, This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. This message was given to the messengers, though all of the disciples heard it. What is astonishing is that the day that Jesus receives this message, Lazarus is already dead. The messenger doesn't know it. Jesus already knows more than the messenger knows that Lazarus has died. When you count up the times from this point, 2 days, boom, over to that point, Lazarus was dying about the same time that the messenger showed up to let Jesus know he's sick, come and help. Jesus already knows that he's dead. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. When he had heard, therefore, that he was sick, he abode 2 days still in the same place where he was. Very astonishing fact. And everyone assumed, all his disciples assumed, well, it's like when the centurion said, you know, speak the words and I know it'll be. But Jesus never said, I heal him. Go back. Your faith has, you know, saved your servant, anything like that. It didn't happen like that. All he observed was, this sickness is not unto death, but it's to glorify God and me. So he does the most remarkable thing. Someone's in dire need of help, and he sits down and stays another 2 days. Now talk about a delay that's hard to explain, humanly hard to explain. And we're going to find out that this delay was absolutely deliberate on God's part. It was to let things go from bad to worse. It was to be sure that when they showed up there, that body was stinking dead. Literally, that it was odorous and a smelly place in that tomb, that the miracle would be all the more stupendous. But we don't realize this, that this could be happening to us in all sorts of settings, that we ask God something, and then God waits 2 days before responding or sending assistance, after the situation has gone from bad to impossible, just as it seems to have in the case of Lazarus. Jesus stayed 2 extra days, just hobnobbing, out of town, away from his friend in need. But we're speaking about God, aren't we? We're not just speaking about... Had this been a doctor who was notified, hey, there's a patient who's ill and needs your help right away, and the doctor decided to take 2 more days of vacation, then travel back to help the patient is dead, they'd sue legitimately for what? Negligence, among other things, and malpractice, you bet. A doctor could not get away with this, could he? A man doing what Jesus did would have been a real scoundrel. This would have been sinful behavior. And so you can imagine how astonished the disciples find out when Jesus said, it's time to go help Lazarus. What have we been doing the last few days here if he was in such dire... That doesn't make any sense that Jesus would delay like that at all, in light of inhuman principles. So, then after that saith he to his disciples, let us go into Judea again. He didn't say Bethany, but they all know they're going to Judea to go to the province of Bethany to help Lazarus. disciples saying to him, Master, the Jews of late sought to stone thee, and goest thou thither again? I mean, didn't we just get out of there because they're ready to kill you and stone you? Jesus answered, Are there not 12 hours in the day? If any man walk in the day, he stumbleth not, because he seeth the light of this world. If a man walk in the night, he stumbleth, because there is no light in him. He's saying that they are operating in the day when they are protected. It is not yet Jesus' time to be judged, and they can walk safely. He's got 12 hours to walk, figuratively speaking. It might be the 11th hour for Jesus. It's just a few weeks away from being killed, of course. But, yeah, and his death is imminent, in other words, in Jerusalem. But he's saying, as long as it's day, we're safe. As long as it's not my time yet to be delivered up. But when, you know, Judas betrayed Christ, it was Judas' hour, the hour of darkness, and it says, and it was night, and Judas left. It's a different time, different. That night signified the symbolic light when Jesus was to be taken and esteemed a man of sorrows who had nothing. But at the moment, they're walking in the light. God, you know, Jesus' ministry is still going full steam. There's not one thing the Jews can do to stop him so long as the time has not yet come. These things say it, said he, and after that he saith unto them, Our friend Lazarus sleepeth, but I go that I may awake him out of sleep. He uses this phrase to try to soften the impact of death. Yes, death is a hard thing, but in Jesus' eyes, it's not something as severe. He mollifies and softens the impact, saying he's simply sleeping. This phraseology is ancient, going back to even Genesis. He was gathered to his fathers, he fell asleep with his fathers. They sleep upon their beds. They enter into their eternal rest. These phrases are from Isaiah, from the Psalms, from Genesis, etc. And, of course, they can be wakened from that sleep unto everlasting righteousness or eternal damnation, according to Daniel 12, 1 and 2. Then said his disciples, Lord, if he's asleep, he shall do well. He's okay then, isn't he? Howbeit Jesus spake of his death, but they thought that he had spoken of taking of rest and sleep. Then said Jesus unto them plainly, Lazarus is dead. To make it very clear, Lazarus is dead. And notice he say in verse 15, And I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, to the intent that ye may believe. Nevertheless, let us go unto him. He said, I am glad that I delayed, that we stuck around 2 days, that he would die. Jesus says some very impressive things here. He says, it was intentional, and I'm glad I delayed. And I'm happy, not just that I'm happy he's dead, but I'm happy for your sakes that I delayed, that your faith would be much greater confirmed. If I heal a man of being sick, that's rather easier matter than to raise someone who's been dead for days, whose body's already decomposing. That's a different story entirely. So I'm glad for your sakes. And we have to see that God's delays, many times, he is glad for our sakes because of them, as much as they might, you know, totally shock us and say, what on earth is going on here? What's God doing? What's God pulling here? Glad for our sakes, and I'm glad that I delayed and that he died. Pretty astonishing words, except that God, being in control of everything, can undo this. And there's some greater lesson to be established with the testimony that the whole world will know, that this will be the down payment, the signal that this man who was able to raise Lazarus is able to raise everybody at the last day. So this is going to be the proof positive that Jesus is the resurrection and the life. Then said Thomas, which is called Didymus, the twin, unto his fellow disciples, Let us go also, that we may die with him. This was not a reproachful thing, but rather they were willing to follow Jesus all the way into death. They were going to march into Jerusalem, into the open throat of death. As far as they're concerned, the Jews hated them so bad and were so dead set on murdering them. Then, when Jesus came, he found that he had lain in the grave 4 days already. It's Lazarus. Now Bethany was nigh unto Jerusalem, about 15 furlongs off. Many of the Jews came to Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. Then Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him, but Mary sat still in the house. Then said Martha unto Jesus, Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. But I know that even now, whatsoever thou wilt ask of God, God will give it to thee. Remember, Jesus did send a message back via messenger. That message was, the sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. He plainly promised that the sickness was not unto death. She said, I believe that. I believe that you're God. Matter of fact, in verse 40, if you turn over there, it says, Jesus saith unto her, this time Mary, or next time Martha again, said I not unto thee that if thou wouldest believe, thou shouldest see the glory of God? Well, that phrase, seest the glory of God, was what was sent by the messenger on the day that messenger showed up to address Jesus and asked for help. Jesus saith unto her, verse 23, thy brother shall rise again. Mary, or Martha, saith unto him, I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. She's a confirmed believer in the resurrection. And Jesus said unto her, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Believest thou this? And she saith unto him, Yea, Lord, I believe that thou art the Christ, the Son of God, which should come into the world. And when she had so said, she went her way and called Mary her sister secretly. Remember, there's some Jews around that still didn't like Jesus, though they were friends of Martha and Mary's, and were there to assist in the mourning process, as it were. But Jesus wasn't, by the way, going to be very secretive about it as Martha is to Mary. He wanted everyone to see it. It was not to be done in a corner, but to be published abroad. The Master is come and calleth for thee. As soon as she heard that, she rose quickly and came unto him. Now Jesus was not yet come into the town, but was in that place where Martha met him. The Jews then which were with her in the house, and comforted her when they saw Mary, that she rose up hastily and went out, followed her, saying, She goeth unto the grave to weep there. Then when Mary was come where Jesus was, and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying unto him, Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. Now, again, Hengstenberg and several others don't believe that there's any reproach in this phrase. They're simply stating a fact. But they're going to trust Jesus, and I'm going to show you how it is that they trusted Jesus with the matter. When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews also weeping with which came with her, he groaned in the spirit, which is literally raged. He was angry in his spirit, and was troubled, and said, Where have ye laid him? And they said unto him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. Then said the Jews, Behold how he loved him. No question that he loved him. By the way, some people say, Why was he crying? Since he knew he was going to save him anyway from death. Well, I think Hengstenberg puts it well. He said, what if he didn't? What if he didn't care? What if he was a cold-hearted fellow, said, Come out. That's not the kind of Savior we have. We have one who is acquainted with grief and affliction and is sympathetic toward our losses and our misery and our pain and our suffering. He sympathizes with us. He suffers with us. And he's angry at death. Death is like this enemy that comes and carries off its prey, and Jesus goes out to advance and to strip death of Lazarus, to knock death on its bottom, as it were, and take Lazarus back from the enemy of the human race that comes to destroy. That's the thing that energizes Jesus' anger and his emotion. And some of them said, Could not this man which opened the eyes of the blind have caused that even this man should not have died? They believe that he could have prevented his death. Now these guys are reproaching Jesus. The Jews who said, hey, you just, unlike, by the way, Mary and Martha, these Jews who are muttering to themselves saying, had he shown up on time, could have saved Lazarus. Of course, Jesus was spared that in one sense because Lazarus was dead when he got the message, because he's been dead 4 days. Jesus delayed 2 days and made the journey and was there 2 days later. 4 days total, Lazarus dead 2 days. Jesus was not culpable, humanly speaking. From a divine point of view, he knew that Lazarus was sick and then died before those events happened, but because he was God, he could handle it. No one had anything to fear. Lazarus had nothing to fear for being in the grave 4 days. Jesus, therefore, again groaning in himself, cometh to the grave. It was a cave, and a stone lay upon it. Jesus said, Take ye away the stone. Martha, the sister of him that was dead, saith unto him, Lord, by this time he stinketh, for he hath been dead 4 days. Jesus specifically wanted to wait till the fourth day when the corruption was bad enough that the body would stink. He picked, in other words, the worst possible time to ask for the stone to be ruled again. God's sense of timing is totally bizarre from the human standpoint. Roll away the stone. Oh, you got to be out of your mind. It stinks in there. It's a grave. And I want to explain why it stinks in there. They did not observe standard Jewish traditional burial. When Jesus was buried, the body was prepared with spices and properly prepared. They did not do this with Lazarus. There were no spices to handle the grave, being the body being decomposed. Why? Because they expected that Jesus was going to do something. They simply put the grave clothes on so he wouldn't be naked in the symbolic gesture, hands and feet showing that no longer does he have to walk or work or sweat of his brow with the grave cloth on his head. Those were what they did do, but they left all the spices out. Even though they had plenty of time to do that, they instructed otherwise. And now they knew the body would be stinking because it was not prepared with the spices. But that was deliberate on Mary and Martha's part because they did have faith in Jesus. to solve the problem. Jesus saith unto her, Said I not unto thee, that if thou shouldst believe, thou shouldst see the glory of God? They took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid, and Jesus lifted up his eyes, and said unto the Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me, and I knew that thou hearest me always, but because of the people which stand by, I said, that they may believe that thou hast sent me. And when he thus had spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. Jesus saith unto him, Loose him, and let him go. And many of the Jews which came to Mary and had seen the things which Jesus did believed on him. Others, of course, went back and reported to the Sanhedrin, and they were furious with this new development. But we can see here that all the timing was atrocious from a human standpoint. Waiting extra 2 days before heading out, asking the grave to be open on the fourth day when the corruption was going to be the worst possible. And all of it with this clause in mind from verse 15. I am glad for your sakes that I was not there. That I wasn't there to save him from dying. Pretty astonishing. And there'll be cases when a nation might go down the tube and God will say, I'm just glad I was not there to save it from perishing for your sakes. Because to the benefit of the world, sometimes, that even good things, what human beings think are good, should perish off the earth and no memory be left of them. Our last phrase is from Revelation, verse 6. Revelation 6. Actually, yeah, that's correct. Now, I've indicated that the Old Testament gives all sorts of time frames for God's delays. Some of them very broad. We see 430 years sojourn in Egypt, or 400 or 430. We see 70 years Babylonian captivity, 490 years from Daniel's prayer to the coming of the Messiah, things like this. But in this period of time, which is called the end of the days or the end of the ages, God doesn't deal this way. That doesn't mean that we don't question his delays, even if we're already in heaven. Verse 9. And when he had opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? And white robes were given unto every one of them, and it was said unto them that they should rest yet for a little season until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled. See, God has a purpose in delaying the judgment here on all those. You're crying, How long, O Lord, do we have to wait before you avenge us of our blood? For we were innocent and we were slain by them. Do you not avenge our blood on the earth? But God does what to his people who ask these kind of questions? He gives them a white linen robe and tells them, wait, to wait upon the Lord. God has more things cooking on earth. In other words, it's not soup yet. Basic message for the universe is, it's not soup yet. Okay? God's not going to act when we expect him to act. He acts when he chooses to act, when he is decreed from all eternity in his own nature, when he will act, and it'll be good for the earth, be good for the world, as God's in control of everything. But it's still interesting to see that the question of delay always is in our minds, because we're tied to time. These saints under the altar who were slain, their souls, says, I saw the souls of them that were slain, said, they are told to wait a little season. It's not a long wait. Our time on earth is a short time to begin with. It's a little season, too. And that little season is the one that's raging down here. It's the period of time during which, what? All of those who are to run their race, run the race. From beginning to end. That's the period of time where God is doing his business, where he's unfolding his heavenly plan on the earth for all nations and peoples. And yes, the question is, how long, O Lord, before you straighten out all accounts? Let him worry about that. It'll be at the perfect time, in due season. Remember that famous phrase from Deuteronomy 32, I think it's verse 34. The evil, the wicked man, he says, their foot shall slip in due season. There'll be a delay. Psalm 37 discusses that strange delay. I don't understand that the wicked, he prospers and does this, and God doesn't do anything about it. But eventually and ultimately, God does do something about it in the best possible time, which will often look like the worst possible time to us. But because it's the best possible time in the big scheme of things, it's right, And we must learn to walk by faith. And walking by faith is to trust God's strange, bizarre timing. Because though it be strange and bizarre, looked at through a human eyeball, it is wonderful, it is wise, it is holy, and it is totally just, and it best governs the universe in all its whole holes and all its parts, much better than our calling God to our timetable. God has no interest in human calendars or anything. He sits enthroned over the heavens. Let me explain what that means. The biggest clock in the world, in all of creation, is this gigantic rotating universe that we all like to discuss, and all these constellations moving around annually, plus the gigantic gyrations of individual galaxies. And we see that they measure small amounts of time, bigger amounts of time. You have a light ray, for example, measures microscopic parts of time. You know, it's got a frequency of more than megahertz, gigahertz or something like that for a light ray. It's a billion times a second, it's kind of pulsing. And then we have the gigantic clock, which are the super galactic clusters rotating around supposedly every billion years or so. You know, they haven't been running that long, but that would be their rotation rate, judging from what we're seeing. So happens that God sits, that is all like a small little wall clock to God that he chuckles at when he looks at it. And we should realize that that's the kind of God with whom we have to do, that the gigantic clock of all the seasons which set forth markers of days and years and times and seasons is something that God sits on top of. It's nothing more than a footstool to him, if you will. The heaven of heavens cannot contain God. He's certainly not going to be ruled by them. And therefore, with a God who is ruler over all time and all history and the future is in his hand, we can, like Abraham, be it busy ourselves about the nasty jobs that we have to do, including our equivalent, 20th century equivalent of taking a stick to the buzzards as we wait faithfully upon God. Even if it means he's working on the sick ill of years or decades or centuries, it doesn't matter. We must be found as faithful as Abraham, our model, who was the friend of God because he never questioned. Take his son up to sacrifice if necessary. Submit to his seed being 400 years enslaved to a strange people. He said, it was good in the eyes of God. It's good with me. We need to see it the same way. We may not be dismayed at God's delay. These are tests of our faith, and we need to pass them as Abraham passed these tests. You know, I'm not sure that many of us would be patient for more than an hour after preparing a sacrifice. And the buzzards start coming down. Once the buzzards start coming down, we say, well, the birds want it more than God wants it. God hasn't accepted the sacrifice yet. Let the birds have it. It's not worth the trouble. We don't see that these things are tests to us in perseverance and living within God's delays. God assumes that we have to live in the process of time. When you do make a sacrifice, you're going to have to defend it against buzzards, aren't you? There's no way in this world that you can have all this fresh meat hanging outside that long without it getting the eye of a vulture. And this is true on all scales, for all businesses, for all schools. There's going to be the equivalent of that, some kind of attack coming. It could be the state coming in with asbestos regulations on the master school over and over again, harassing them about this or that. And you're saying, boy, this was God. Why doesn't he just relieve the problem? Sometimes he does. There was the Everett Sullivan's church, which was padlocked. I forget now the state that it happened in. Upshot of it was that ultimately the man who was in charge of the prosecution against the church, after this it was all overturned in the church's favor, the man perished, died. As a matter of fact, several people involved either lost their jobs or actually passed away from illnesses that suddenly cropped up. But it wasn't until after the pastor had spent some months in prison, reading two books, by the way, the Bible and Institutes of Biblical Law, the entire time. God apparently had it in his heart that this should happen to the pastor, and then he dealt with the man who put him in jail unrighteously, which was the attorney general of that state. So God's delays, divine delays, we submit to them, we wait upon God, and there should be nothing that he could ask of us in the way of that wait, including duty against vultures, today's vultures, if you will, things that hack at us and aggravate us and annoy us and tend to bite at us, and not despair and stand our ground. And you know something? That's hard. And that's why we need to live by faith, not by sight, not by clocks, not by calendars. But the temptation is hard. Even those who have already gone to be with Jesus in heaven ask, how long, Lord, before you avenge our blood? There are ways to a holy anger about it and a righteous zeal, and they're still told, wait, God's plans haven't finished. It's not soup yet.